from 10. So get out, here we go.
For the past 86 years, on Thanksgiving night, the lighting of the Country Club Plaza has marked the beginning of the holiday season.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the place to be for some and the madhouse to avoid for others, but an important citywide ritual for sure. This year, Thanksgiving was a cold, rainy night, so some people stayed home, but a crowd still gathered with umbrellas. The Kansas City Star captured this sound from the festivities in a video. It's hard to imagine Kansas City without the plaza lights, or without the plaza for that matter. There's something timeless about it, but the district's also changed a lot, and now you can buy it for just $303 million. That's right, as you may have heard, the plaza's for sale. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. And now let's start the show by hearing what holiday shoppers think the plaza is worth in 2015, financially and otherwise.
Like in dollars? I mean, millions of dollars, I imagine. But I mean, like for the city, I think it's worth a lot. I mean, shopping, the architecture, yeah, the Spanish, the feel of it. And it's outdoor shopping as well, which is nice. It's not like your Oak Park Mall, not your indoor shopping center.
So historical. I mean, it goes back to like our parents and beyond, you know? I'm in agriculture. My parents bought one of their first pieces of equipment for the farm on the plaza, down the street at Sears. So, and then
Five and Dime. I used to shop at the Five and Dime when I was...
And there was one that were like Woolworths or something, wasn't there?
Yeah, well, that's what we called the Five and Dime, is what I called it. Yeah.
Yes, it was that way.
And it
was right down here.
They come if you come have lunch on the plaza with your youth group or with your girlfriend.
And the Pooches, we always came to Pooches.
Yeah,
Pooches.
Exactly.
Pooches.
I heard it was worth like over $1 billion. Like I've heard the numbers are getting pretty high. It's not like, I mean, there's lots of kind of strip mall-ish mixed development things like around the city, especially like on the outskirts, like Zona Rosa and all that. But I don't know. This is just, it has a lot more character. I mean, I'm born and raised here, so I just know that when our like family comes to town from Nebraska, and I've heard this from my friends too, when people come in town, like you always take them to the plaza, you know, that's just like a thing that you do.
I lived in Chicago for 18 years and now I'm back in Kansas City. It seems to be a lot of chain stores. The restaurants that are going up are just kind of chain restaurants as well. Nothing unique.
Shopping down here, I don't ever think there's a very many bargains, you know? You come down here, you gotta have a pretty good stash in your pocket, you know?
That's why I said, if you go to St. Louis or Dallas, you've got the Gallerias. So, mm-hmm. But this is a little more unique.
Come and look and get a few things and eat.
Today, as the monetary value of the plaza hangs in the balance, we want to explore the value of the neighborhood more broadly. So what's it worth to you, and has that changed? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. We've got a historian, a plaza resident, and a community organizer joining us for this discussion. Let's start with the historian, Monroe Dodd. Hi, Monroe.
Good morning, Gina.
So tell me about the humble beginnings of the plot of land now known as the plaza. What was it before it was the plaza?
Until 1897, which sounds like a long time ago, but wasn't that long ago in terms of the beginning of the plaza. It was just rural land outside the city limits of Kansas City. It only went as far south as Westport at the time. Then it was annexed, and as all kinds of lands are annexed, they become less rural. Streets are built, houses go up, buildings go up. But along the way, in the late teens, J.C. Nichols, Miller's father, had the idea. He was a developer. He was looking to develop residential districts south of Brush Creek. And he had the idea that maybe the people who lived in those developments would like a nice place to shop. He wanted nice developments.
So there were already people living there.
Oh, right, right. And he had various developments here and there, and then his country club district began to grow in the 1910s south of Brush Creek. These were upper-end, tonier sort of residences, middle class for what the middle class was growing in those days, and definitely upper-end developments. And he wanted a shopping center that could work for them. He also wanted a shopping center that could work for the automobile. So he had this idea of beginning some shops, small at first, with just a florist here, a music store there, a Piggly Wiggly grocery here, and the plaza over time grew and grew in what had been farmland. I've seen a picture of cattle sort of roaming around on what was said to be 47th and Broadway. There's a legend, at least, that it was once bordered by a pig farm. There was definitely a rock quarry and a brickyard just up the hill that created oodles of dust that his residents of his new subdivisions didn't much like. He was involved in a long fight to get rid of that. So it was a humble little area along a humble little place called Brush Creek.
What was it about the location that appealed to J.C. Nichols? Did he see something in this plot of land that others didn't, or was it sort of widely recognized as like there's potential here?
I don't think it was widely recognized. I think what he saw was its proximity to his residential districts. It wasn't far from the Kansas City Country Club, which was then in a very Tony place, sitting where Luce Park does now.
I like that word, Tony.
Yeah. I think Tony is the word that people who aspire to it like to attach to that. But the Country Club was there, and we all know what the Country Club means before it moved over to Mission Hills. And the Country Club district is the residences surrounding it, so why not the Country Club Plaza just north of it? I think he saw it as a natural, also sort of a bowl. You can look at it and you can see why a developer might want to go in there near a little creek that, for heaven's sakes, had never caused much trouble flooding and wouldn't for many decades.
There's a lot of, like, glamour in what you're describing. I mean, pigs notwithstanding. But, like, also, I'm catching an undercurrent of exclusivity. And, you know, I'm curious about that dynamic. Was that formalized in any way, or was it just an air of desirability?
Well, exclusivity, in one sense, in our lives and the lives of our grandparents and great grandparents and everything, is brought about by expensive stuff. If it's expensive to shop in a place, I might not shop there because I don't have enough money to go in there. I don't have that stash of money they were talking about. That makes it, in a certain sense, exclusive. Only a certain income level might go there. By the same token, only a certain income level might live in the districts that J.C. Nichols had. His idea was to make money by creating places that people, especially people with money, wanted to go. That's how a lot of guys can make, a lot of all sexes can make money in the world, by creating things that people with money aspire to have or to own. And so he did that in the Country Club Plaza. He made it different by strictly controlling it, by seeing to it that it was a harmonious, that it had an architectural theme, a harmony. He'd done this in the Brookside shops before that, the Crestwood shops, a different a nationality theme. Those were mostly British kind of either colonial or medieval. But the Country Club Plaza, he adopted the theme of a Spanish motif. And he looked for the orderliness that had been created in a place like Paris in the 19th century when they rebuilt the city with beautiful wide boulevards, more regular places. He thought this would appeal to the upper income people that he wished to have come there.
What did this district, the plaza, represent to people when it first appeared?
It represented, I'm certain I wasn't alive then, but I'm certain it represented a place that, wow, that's a really nice place. Let's see if we can walk in there and see what they have. Now remember, the plaza began small, a grocery store here, a music studio there, a florist, and it just grew and grew over time. Unlike today's major shopping developments, when a big thing goes up like Leawood Town Center or Zona Rosa, it tends to spring full-blown with all the shops rented and everything. The plaza grew little by little over time. For a while, there was a riding academy where Seville Square now is, and a riding academy makes big fields with lots of horses hanging around there. So I think people saw these places as probably a nice beginning, but it wasn't until the plaza gained sort of a critical mass in the late 20s and definitely into the 30s that people thought, now that's a nice place to go visit and take out-of-towners.
Are there major turning points in the history of the plaza that you can identify as moments when something shifted in terms of the plaza's identity or its relationship to the city?
Closer to our own time, in the late 1970s, the flood that's been called the Plaza Flood killed more people downstream, but it did a lot of property damage along Brush Creek in the plaza. It caused a major rethinking on the part of the Nichols Company. It was their opportunity to make the plaza even more upscale than it had been. The plaza had bowling alleys, movie theaters, little box theaters in the basement. It had had a Woolworths. It had had a Sears store. It had everyday things in addition to high-end things. Over time, in the 70s and into the 80s, the everyday things began to fade away and the high-end things began to replace them. Over time also, chains came to replace local stores. Mark Shale went into a building that had been owned by a local store named Swanson's. Halls, a local corporation, has now left the plaza.
Monroe, hang with me for a second. I want to hear from Plaza resident Susie Hake. Hi, Susie.
Good morning, Gina. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm great, thanks.
How long have you been living in the plaza?
Well, I have lived where I live now for 26 years, but I was actually born and raised on the plaza, just on the south end of the plaza, and moved away for a while, but then came back home.
Tell me the story of the plaza as you have experienced it up close and personal.
Well, the plaza has meant so much to my life and to my family and my friends, as a matter of fact. I use a wheelchair, and so I can still remember in the early 60s my friends pushing me from 54th and Main down to the plaza to go shopping and to have a 5-cent Coke at Woolworths. So I just have wonderful, wonderful memories. And now for the last 26 years, it's been part of my front yard. And so I spend a lot of time there for various reasons, to be honest with you. I wanted to chat a little bit about the exclusivity that we talked about earlier, because I see so much inclusiveness now. And I think part of that is the start of the Americans with Disabilities Act that was signed in early 90s, because the plaza had to make their the whole district accessible to everyone. And so and then, as I was telling your producer earlier, the weekends are wonderful places. It's wonderful times to spend on the plaza, because it is such a welcoming environment and neighborhood. You see people of all colors, of all dress, of all nationalities coming in and enjoying the plaza now, and I really love that.
Do your memories of the plaza, like growing up, I mean, you have a frame of reference that is both so deep because you actually live in this place, but also over a period of time where you've witnessed change. Do your memories of the plaza exist in any kind of contrast to what you see happening there today? Or is it the same place you've always known?
Oh, to Monroe's point, lots of changes as far as type of stores and restaurants that are there. Many of us still remember House of Toy and Trail House and, oh my gosh, the bowling alley that you referred to.
There was a bowling alley?
Oh, yes. It was great. I know many of the people who met their spouses at that bowling alley on the plaza. And so it was very much of a homegrown environment of stores that were locally owned, and you knew the owners and you knew their families. Now, to your point, Monroe, things have changed. I know Highwoods has really tried to include that, but...
To include local businesses?
But they're a business and they need to make money, so it's easier to bring in the big box stores or the national chain stores.
Is this a change that you've seen happening in that 17 years that Highwoods has owned this property? I mean, how would you characterize the last 17 years under Highwoods?
I would definitely say that it's happened in the last 17 years. It's my understanding that their expertise is more commercial development and office development as opposed to retail development. And so I will look forward to the new owner in hopes that they have a lot more retail experience in bringing a more variety of stores into the area.
Do you fear what comes next as the property changes hands, or is it a welcome opportunity for change on the plaza?
I think it's a welcome opportunity. Now, Highwoods has been very attentive to people with disabilities issues. I need to share that, and also to our neighbors. But I'm really looking forward to a new change to indoctrinate the new owners into what Kansas City is really like, and hopefully we can really negotiate that.
Well, we'd love to hear what the plaza means to you and what you think it's worth to the city. I mean, what is the relationship of this district, the plaza, to Kansas City in your view? 816-235-2888. I'll go ahead and talk with Keith on the plaza. Hi, Keith.
Hi. How are you today?
Great. How about you?
I'm very good. I'm glad you're talking about this. One of the interesting things is I'm the president of South Plaza Neighborhood Association, which is just south of the plaza. Mr. Nichols was one of the first actually to empower homes associations with self-governance, which is true of many of the areas like Countryside to the south and Crestwood, where they had control over their neighbors and even the structure of their homes. Unfortunately, like I think someone mentioned, at the same time, there was a lot of racism and anti-Semitism, and those things have been removed. The other thing that happened, interestingly, is he really recognized communities as a part of the heart of any neighborhood. So he identified many of the actual neighborhoods that now exist, as well as created those homes associations. And for the longest time, I think that the structure of those was that we all went to the plaza. For one thing or another, there were services, there was a grocery store, there was a pharmacy. The plaza that we know today doesn't really serve the neighborhood in those ways. We have some of our own things in our own neighborhoods. But I would hope as it comes into a new era that it might return to some of that. It's always going to be a destination. Right now, much of the money that's made there is people who come from out of town to see the plaza. But at the same time, the neighborhoods are really become more successful because of the plaza, and the plaza because of the neighborhood.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thanks, Keith. That's an interesting idea, and it also does bring up for me whether we consider the plaza a neighborhood per se or more of an entertainment or shopping district. I mean, when you think of a place, I mean, the city has created formal entertainment districts now. Is the plaza kind of one of these purpose-driven districts, or is it a neighborhood?
I really think it's both. Those of us who live surrounding the plaza and in the plaza, it is our go-to place to go get coffee or to go get a bite to eat. And so I think it really is I consider it our neighborhood, at least.
When you consider that J.C. Nichols was not a shopping center developer, he was a residential developer who also put shopping districts near his residential developments to make them even bigger. Today, the world is segmented into so many sorts of people. This guy develops this woman develops that. J.C. Nichols developed both. He thought that these things worked kind of, absolutely symbiotically. To make sure they worked well, he built those big apartment towers, what used to seem big compared to some of the newer buildings today, across Brush Creek, and smaller apartment buildings on the north side of Brush Creek, some of which have been demolished today. But those were meant to bring people who would use his grocery store, his Piggly Wiggly or his Wolferman's, who would bowl in the bowling alley, go to the movie theater, go to the Find a Dime at the post office. It was all sort of one thing. Unlike an entertainment district like the district north of I-70 is now inside the south part of the Loop, that was set up for restaurants and bars and things. The plaza was a part of all one big dream.
Can we talk about race on the plaza for a minute? All of Kansas City was segregated in the early days of the plaza, but it's also no secret that J.C. Nichols was implemented racially restrictive covenants in his developments. Monroe, what do you know about how race played into the development of the plaza?
It played as one of those things. Unfortunately, in through today's eyes, it's difficult to address this. But it played into one of those things that says, who has money? In the 1920s, 30s, 40s, because of segregation and the penalties that it caused to an entire group of people, it was white people who had money. White people were largely the middle class. White people were almost entirely the upper income end of things. And so race played into that. If you wish to have homes that yield you a lot of money as a developer, you want to do high-end homes to do that, you'll probably have to exclude black people. I have to rush to point out here that J.C. Nichols did not create housing discrimination. Kansas City was rife. In fact, I seriously doubt there were very many developers in Kansas City, whether they just developed a couple of lots or an entire country club district, as Nichols did, who didn't set race as one of the factors, and sometimes even religion. It was common in those days to do that. Unfortunate as it is, it was the world they lived in for whatever reason.
Celia Ruiz joins us by phone. She's a community organizer with the group Una Lucha KC, and she's lived in Kansas City most of her life. Celia, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Actually, I've lived here my entire life. I don't mind saying my age. I was born in 79, born, raised in east side of Kansas City, you know, and kind of went to school anywhere between northeast and then south Kansas City. So I think, we were well versed with the areas of the city.
Growing up here, what was your experience with the plaza?
I think I may have mentioned this once before. As the gentleman just mentioned right now, that it's, maybe difficult to address race and the times that, that were happening before us. It was true. So I remember us passing. Okay, so it would be Broadway, not Main. Yeah. So we would be heading Broadway south. And I remember actually my dad, he used to love to drive around and look at houses. And we would do that Sundays after church and just drive around. So I'd love to drive around. And so then we would drive south Broadway, going down south. And then I remember looking right into the plaza area and thinking, wow, that looks really cool and fancy. And then that was immediately shot down by my parents saying, that's for white people. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, how did you, obviously, when you're a kid and someone tells you something like that, you don't have a language in your head to really like capture how you're responding and how you're feeling. But as an adult, how do you look back on that moment?
I'm hearing, I love storytelling. I love stories. And so then I loved hearing from the historian right now. And I would have loved to have, had a cooler picture, of how the plaza started off, those five and dime stores. I would love to hear those kinds of stories. So then now as an adult and hearing these other conversations right now, I missed out on at least that storytelling, even if they were different times. And even if we were to have felt excluded, because that's the way it was in 79 or 81 or 83 or whatever year it would have been, it kind of sucks to have missed, at least just hearing a story. Now, the only reason I go to the plaza is for the Apple store. Occasionally, if I want to kill some time and I get off early from work and I don't mind, some parking, then I'll go over to Barnes & Noble. But other than that, it's just the Apple store. So now, when I was younger, it was, sorry, that's not for you. And during my teen years, again, I went to school and kind of like the South Kansas City high school. I could have had access to that because that's where people went. I wasn't interested at that point. I didn't care to go. It meant nothing to me. And now as an adult, all it means to me is the Apple store.
So is it just that there isn't something that caters to what you would be doing? It sounds like there's one need that you have that is fulfilled by all of these stores, and it happens to be found in one spot. I'm curious, a few years ago, teens were congregating on the plaza in large numbers. Some were creating a disturbance, but there was also a feeling out there that part of what people were reacting to might simply have been the presence of large groups of young people of color in a traditionally white space. A curfew was put into place. Editorials were written about preserving nightlife in the, quote, crown jewel of Kansas City. What's been your reaction to watching all of that unfold, Celia?
Like, it really hurts because, if in 79 my parents, or let's say 85, my parents would have said, yeah, you can go there. You can go anywhere you want. When I would have become a teenager, I would have been that, and I don't know, whatever age it is, 13, 14, 15, whatever age kids are going out there, or whatever kind of normal age the kids start to go out, that would have been me. And I was a typically normal kid. I would not have been interested in going in any, probably the only place within the plaza would have been the movies. Because even now, what else would kids want to go to out there? There are bowlings. I don't think it's, it's not the cool place for kids right now.
How about you, Susan? What's been your observation of how the plaza has has evolved in terms of who's there, who's welcome, and how it maybe hasn't evolved. I mean, even watching the same set of incidents that Celia is reacting to.
My only experience with the youth on the plaza have been very positive. There are times when I roll from Grand Street Cafe back home to 46th and Warnell, and there was, I can remember one night on a Saturday night, I was rolling home, and the sidewalks were packed with kids. They were all very respectful of me. I said, excuse me, oh, hi, ma'am, that's fine, you know, go ahead. They were all, every single one of them were very respectful. So that is the experience I want to share and to know that people can experience the same thing as I do.
Do you think that the kind of media attention that existed surrounding those incidents, do you think that that's affected people's perception of the plaza's value and desirability?
I am very concerned about that, yes.
Celia, what about you? I mean, when we say people's perceptions of the value and desirability of the plaza, that's everyone's perceptions. Does it make the plaza more or less desirable to you?
You know, I'm a little bit lost. Can you repeat that again? Sorry.
Yeah, just do the incidents that we've been talking about that inspired curfews for teens and just big groups of people on the plaza and the reactions to them. Does that conversation around the plaza affect how much value you see in this district?
You know, I think the reaction piece is the scarier piece, because sometimes, you know, if that was the, you know, situation, you know, with the lady right now that, I apologize, I didn't catch your name, but
Susie,
you know, Susie, that, you know, that you felt comfortable and it was a positive experience. Sometimes it's the louder people, it's the more negative people, or it's the idea of wanting to see something more negative, you know, that's going to grab more attention. And it's not fair, you know, and so then that starts to build up. I'm not going to get into the whole Trump deal, but, you know, what happens is, you know, a lot of people are talking about it and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And so then between the media coverage, between, you know, the perceptions that we think that maybe others may have of a certain situation, then that starts to grow. And that's the damaging piece.
Monroe, as a historian, I mean, this comes up a lot when we think about race in our city, just, and other issues in the city. We want to reconcile the things we love about a place, our nostalgia, its character, with a sort of rocky past from a racial and even economic perspective. How do you go about wrapping your mind around what you need to make a place change while preserving, you know, what you love about it?
Well, maybe those of us who out in the population who think, gosh, it's really going to seed out there. Look at the mess that's been created. If we would stop and think, perhaps our fears are looming greater in our minds than reality, then I think that might help a lot. Now, if I'm sitting in my car and someone comes up and jumps on the hood, I'm not going to be very happy about that. And that's reality.
No, certainly not.
Fortunately for us, we have a police chief, and I believe a mayor, too, who understand this. The police chief has said, we're not going to limit who can go in the plaza, but we are definitely going to stop people from committing crimes. And that's the big difference. It's the fear of the crime that outweighs, you know, perpetrated by whoever's on YouTube or whatever video has been taken that exists in the minds of people and is magnified. You see this all around the world today, but it's also true in Kansas City and the Country Club Plaza. If we can somehow learn, and I don't know what the prescription is for that, to separate our exaggerated fear from the more comfortable reality that actually exists, I think maybe that's the solution.
Susie Hake, what's your greatest hope for the future of the plaza under new ownership?
I'm looking forward to a new sensitivity to retailers, a new sensitivity to all consumers who come to the plaza, and maybe a little bit more architectural barriers being eliminated. So I'm looking forward to that.
Susie Hake, Monroe Dodd, and Celia Ruiz, thank you so much for being here today.
Quite welcome. Thank you.
Gina. Thank you very much.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and next, a round table of Santas in costume on KCUR's Central Standard. Don't go away.
Santa buddy, one thing that I really do need, the deed to a platinum mine, Santa Pally saw her down the chimney tonight.